Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. The federal NDP this week reignited a national debate over childcare by proposing a universal $15 per day childcare program. I spoke with two guests, Angela McEwen of the Canadian Labour Congress and Peter Nilsson of the Swedish Left Party, to get, respectively, a closer and broader perspective on the prospect of universal childcare in Canada. First up, my interview with Angela McEwen. Angela is an economist with the Canadian Labour Congress and has long been a strong advocate for public childcare. So maybe we can start with a question about some background. What's the current model of childcare in Canada outside Quebec, where there already is a universal system is $7 per day? And why isn't this model in the rest of Canada working?
So in the rest of Canada, there are, again, it varies by province, but generally speaking, what we have is some subsidized spaces, not enough subsidized spaces, but there are some subsidized spaces that are available that are usually means tested. Then we have the $100 a month payment from the federal government, which is meant to help people with their childcare choices, whatever that might be. And so there aren't enough childcare spaces that have been created. So in a lot of provinces like Alberta and Saskatchewan, you have a huge number of not licensed daycare places, basically people with kids of their own that take in their friends' kids and or neighbors and make a living doing that. And they don't necessarily have any health standards or any safety inspections. And so that can be very concerning for parents because the safety just isn't there. But parents rely on it because it's the best thing that they can find. The other thing that we see is parents who cut back on paid work in order to stay home with their kids because they're not comfortable or they can't find quality spaces for their kids. That's not always an option. Some people in families, in order to make ends meet, they need both parents working full time. So,
right, because the price ends up being high as well, right?
Right. So outside of the subsidized spaces, because there aren't enough spaces and the demand is so high that especially in urban areas, you can see up to $2,000 a month for one childcare space. So because there aren't enough spaces, the price goes up quite high. And so it becomes very unaffordable. It's the second highest expenditure for most families after their mortgage.
Well, so given this situation, maybe I'll put you a bit on the spot. What's your sort of 2-minute pitch for universal childcare, in particular on economic grounds?
So there are two main reasons to have universal childcare. One is because it provides that quality, that standard, if we're administering it publicly. It provides that quality and that standard of care for the child. And the second is that it gives both parents the opportunity to participate in the paid labor force, which is good for the family if that's their choice. And it's good for the general economy. We have an aging labor force, and we need to keep people in the labor force if they're willing to be in the labor force. So if what we saw in Quebec that happened when they introduced childcare was that more women participated in the labor force, and their wages, they closed the wage gap. So childcare has an impact both on equity for women, both in terms of their ability to participate in the labor force full time and in the wages that they can command. So that's a good thing for women, and that's a good thing for the economy. Then we're using the talents of both of those parents equitably. And the kids are in a place where they're safe, where they're learning and socializing together.
Given the higher labor force participation, what do you think has contributed to the history of sort of false starts and failures we've seen so far on a national level? I mean, shouldn't businesses be excited about this additional freed up labor force that childcare, increased childcare would bring?
So this is, I think, something that is almost on the scale of a public good like healthcare, where the individual employer can probably always replace the labor more cheaply by not paying for childcare, by outsourcing that to the parents to pay for themselves. But if society as a whole picks up that burden and subsidizes childcare, the additional tax revenue that you get back from the parents working actually pays for most of it. And then the other benefits that we see make it totally worthwhile in terms of the whole society and the whole economy for them to do it. The other things that happens, right, BC has a really well thought through plan, the $10 a day plan, where they talk about the need for options like for shift workers or for drop-in for stay-at-home parents, and the need to work with the provinces to focus on, they have a plan to spend for 10% of spaces, to spend twice as much in low-income, high-need areas. So this isn't a one-size-fits-all kind of thing that we need. We need to work with the provinces to come up with options that meet the needs of parents.
And how can a universal program like this be funded? You said that it mostly pays for itself. You know, that might take some time. Is merely sort of undoing or not carrying out tax breaks, like I think the NDP are proposing, is that enough? Are there other kinds of fiscal measures that could fund adequate childcare nationally that would be also beneficial?
So what happened is in Quebec is that the higher tax revenue, so many more mothers were working, and they were earning higher wages, that the additional tax that they paid at the provincial and federal level covered the subsidy to the program. It's also a job creation stimulative program. So because child care centers tend to source things very locally, it's their multiplier in the local area is quite strong in terms of if you're going to invest in something that has a real impact regionally. So they tend to source their food locally and any of the other things that they need, they source locally. So it has a strong regional economic development impact. There's been research in Manitoba on that impact, and it's fantastic. So most of it comes from the higher income tax revenue, honestly. But then there are also linkages in the community and less money spent in terms of if you eliminate the child care credit on your income tax, right? If you get the subsidy, then you don't get that child care tax credit. That also helps because you're saving some tax expenditures there.
Right. Maybe I'll close with one last thing. You're active on social media. I see you engaging with the right wing economists. Maybe putting yourself out there. One of the arguments that's been out there is that, you know, a universal program like childcare would be actually regressive. So you know, so the right economists are painting themselves as the sort of bastions of progressivism. They're carrying this flag forward. What's your response to these types of arguments? You know, they point to the fact that you have lower take up among lower income people in Quebec or things like that. Is a universal service regressive?
So I think it's important to have a universal service because that's how you get it implemented. That's how you get buy-in, first of all, to get it implemented, if there's widespread support for a program, right? And then once you have it in place, that's how you keep quality high, is if you have buy-in from middle-income and higher-income parents, there's less of a stigma around making sure that it's well-funded, that it's supportive, that it's quality, if it's everybody's kid that's doing it, right? If it's just the low-income kids, they tend to have to make do with much less money and resources. So in order to have a high-quality program, I think it needs to be universal. In order to have buy-in from taxpayers, it needs to be universal. Universal programs do tend to be regressive. You know, like roads, I drive on the road on a bus and somebody who has a lot of money drives on with their Mercedes-Benz, right? So fixing potholes on the road, that benefits the guy driving the Mercedes-Benz a lot more than it does me on the bus, right? So, and healthcare. My master's project was on unmet needs in healthcare based on socioeconomic status. So, in Canada, we have universal healthcare, but we don't have universal pharmacare. So, I actually get more out of healthcare because I know that I can afford the drugs. I have a drug plan through my employer. But there are people in Canada who don't even bother going to the doctor because they know they won't be able to pay for the medicine that the doctor prescribes them. So there are perverse incentives like that throughout our system, even with so-called very progressive things like universal healthcare. We have to think about that and try to put something in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. This particular study is from 2004, so it's 10 years old, that said there was higher pickup in higher income for higher income earners in Quebec. So I would be interested in seeing a new study. And the other thing is that this particular public service that we're providing allows you to go out into the market to earn money. So it makes sense that people in the higher income bracket are more likely to also be participating in childcare because the fact of participating in the program allows you to earn more money.
Right, and they have better opportunities outside as well, anyways, right?
Exactly. So we need to make sure that we have other programs in place for low-income people who don't have those opportunities in the marketplace, or who are choosing to stay home with their kids. So making sure that we have recreation facilities that are affordable for parents to come in and have their kids play soccer or have swimming lessons that are affordable for those families, right? And to make sure that we have the child tax credit that we have that's fantastic and is really more like going towards a guaranteed income supplement for families with young children that can help them afford to stay home with their kids if that's what they've chosen. So we need to have a mix of policy measures to address that. And I think we do. I think we have that. I think what we're missing is childcare.
Thanks so much, Angela, for taking the time.
Okay, thank you.
That was Angela McEwen, economist with the Canadian Labour Congress. My second guest today is Peter Nielsen. Peter is the press secretary for the Left Party in the Stockholm Municipal Government and is a board member of the Institute for Marxist Socialist Studies, also in Stockholm. Hoping to gain some broader insight into the challenges faced by an expansion of the welfare state in Canada, like the introduction of universal childcare, I spoke with him about the recent history of the Swedish model of the welfare state. This is something he wrote about recently in Jacobin magazine in an article under the title Sweden Without Illusions. Here's my conversation with Peter. So Peter, as I mentioned, Canada's Social Democratic Party, the NDP, has just reignited the debate around childcare in this country, and they've proposed a universal system. Your country, Sweden, is still seen by many social democrats around the world as the model for such universal social services and the welfare state in general. What many, I think, don't quite know is that the Swedish model has actually changed quite dramatically over the past couple decades. Maybe you could give a quick summary of what it means to look at Sweden, as I know you've put it, without illusions.
Yeah, there's this joke on the Swedish left that everyone would want the Swedish model, and also the Swedes would want it perhaps more than anyone, because what's considered to be the Swedish model is actually a model that peaked in maybe late 70s, early 80s, and has since gone through quite the same developments as the rest of Europe, I would say. There's a neoliberal wave in general. But because Sweden started at such a high level of wage compression and equality in terms of gender differences and so forth, the Sweden is still basically an equal country in compared to other European countries. But at the same time, we have the fastest growth in class differences within the OECD. It seems that the development, when the Social Democrats turned rightwards in 1986 or something, there was actually a lot of the development that had taken place in other European countries came in quite a few swift blows. We had a crisis in the early 90s that exaggerated the development. So in just a few years, we had huge increases in class differences, and this struck a blow towards the universal welfare system because it was always based on the fact that we had a high wage compression, which included the middle classes, in the same universal welfare system as the rest. And they felt that since the quality of welfare was at such a high level, they were prepared to pay taxes to finance it. But as soon as you cut financing for the welfare sector, then the level of quality drops and the middle classes opt out for private solutions.
What's actually changed specifically in the way that social services like childcare, like education, like these others are delivered in Sweden now compared to...
Actually, childcare is one of the ones that have the least amount of change because it's so universally used. There's basically, I guess, almost all children between 1.5 years and 5 years attend public childcare. There's been entrance of private corporations within the public sector, which we didn't used to have. We only had basically universal public healthcare and schools and so forth. But during the last 10 to 20 years, there's been the entrance of private corporations and even venture capitalists. At the moment, Sweden is the only country in the world that allows venture capitalists within the school sector.
Quite the turnaround.
Yeah. There's only Chile under Pinochet and Sweden. So and that's led to numerous scandals within the school sector and within the healthcare and so forth. But that in turn, that led to a wave of protests. That actually was one of the things that toppled the right-wing coalition in the last election. And now we'll probably see some sort of cap on the level of profits within the public sector.
Actually, I want to go back to something that you said in response to the previous question. And actually, I think you wrote about this as well. I was intrigued by this line that you said that, you know, what happens when you sort of break out of this kind of virtuous circle that creates equality and wins broad support for these sort of top quality services. And you said that, you know, when public no longer means high quality, it becomes a sort of fallback alternative in a dull gray color. I like this phrase, but I wanted to see if you can maybe expand on it. You know, how does undermining services lead into this kind of vicious circle?
Yeah, there's this misconception about the Nordic welfare state that it was only possible because there was a high level of trust within the population. But in later years, research has shown that it's actually, you know, it's an effect of the fact of a universal welfare system that people come to trust each other. And the welfare system as a reflection of this, the trust within the population. But if you look at, for example, Friedman's more polemical work, he says that if you want to cut the welfare system, you run it on you cut the subsidies and you run it on deficit for a few years, so the quality drops, and then people won't be interested in defending the welfare system. So that's actually what the right wing always does when they come to power. They cut subsidies, so the level of, for example, public schools drop, and then they propose private schools, and people start saying, well, if the public schools are, you know, if the level of public schools is so bad, then we have to have private alternatives for people who can afford it. That was an ideological attack. It was quite a conscious strategy from commerce and the right-wing politicians in Sweden. And it can be, you can find it in internal documents that it's an explicit strategy to undermine the trust in the welfare system. But at the same time, just to point out that in Sweden, there's between 80 and 90% of the public say that they would be willing to pay higher taxes to fund a higher level of welfare. So it's the expectancy of a general level of welfare is still at quite a high level in Sweden. It's just not being pushed by any political party outside of the left party.
Right. Actually, I wanted to ask you about that. You know, you said that the political system has become sort of Americanized into two opposing blocks in Sweden, and they both sort of go after this mythical swing voter, like what happens in the States, and this, you know, this causes sort of centrism and basically pushes these electoral blocks closer together. What do you think accounts for this disconnect between this high level of support that you cited for welfare improvements and you know, willingness to pay for them, and what's actually happening politically? What are the sort of political economic developments that underpin this?
Well, in Sweden, traditionally, the Social Democrats have been in power for over 80 of the last 100 years, and almost a single majority party for most of the time, but usually in coalition with what used to be the Farmers' Party or the Liberal Party. And this meant that they had a political project. It was this thing called the Enlightenment Plan, which is the most famous example of this. And the idea was actually to produce a population that was homogeneous and equal. It was an actual strategy to knock out capital with less ability to compete, and therefore transfer capital and funds to more productive corporations and so forth. And Sweden had one of the most successful, or maybe the most successful, Fordist strategy of all countries. There's no economy that has quite paralleled that. And this produced kind of a unique, like we had a social democratic party in government, and we had a social democratic state that produced people that kind of a social democratic mindset. But this strategy, it's riddled with internal conflicts, and this becomes apparent in the late 70s. A few of the things that were part of the Minor Plan stopped working. The idea was to transfer. They kept wages lower in companies with higher productivity to transfer them to the public sector, but it didn't really work, and the big corporations had super profits. So the wage earners funds was a proposal to solve that conflict. And the idea was that Sweden had attained the political democracy with the right to vote, and then we had a public democracy with the welfare state, and now we're going to have economic democracy by actually buying corporations for the working class. Well, to make a long story short, the limits of the Fordist strategy became apparent in the late 70s, because the welfare state was always being bought with productivity gains. It never really, you know, the division between labor and capital stayed basically the same. But the level of productivity growth was at such a level that you can buy welfare gains even though capital at the same level of profit. But the level of productivity and the conditions at work became so heightened during the late 70s that there was a wave of wildcat strikes. That was a protest against this model that had worked, you know, between 32 and 79 or something. And after that, the Social Democrats become kind of a traditional, you know, third way Social Democratic Party. They set an inflation target. They allow unemployment to rise. They export companies roll back and so forth. And Sweden becomes kind of a traditional European country in that sense. And then what happens is that the right wing parties who traditionally never could unite in Sweden to form an electoral alliance do so. And it becomes very successful, and they win two elections in a row, which is unheard of before that. And this forces the Social Democrats, who are now at a historical low level, to enter into a coalition with the Greens. And, well, they tried with the Left Party, and now they're outside of government. But that kind of polarized the Swedish political system. And the Social Democrats feel that they have to win back the middle-class swing voters that went to the right-wing coalition. So now all of the political debate is centered on people living in urban areas with middle class conditions.
What's maybe as a last question, I'll ask you something about going forward now. You know, what is the struggle over the future of the Swedish welfare state, specifically from your position in the Left Party? Are you going back without sort of nostalgia? Is the effort to get back to something that was, or is it sort of something somewhat different, especially after its failed strategy?
Yeah, I think there's a danger in becoming nostalgic about the Swedish welfare state, because, I grew up at the peak of the Swedish welfare state, and it was in many ways a better society than what we have today. But at the same time, as I said, it was riddled with internal contradictions, and it wasn't socialism, it wasn't a perfect state. And there were a lot of the new left, you know, the left of 68 and so forth. They had a lot of critique of the welfare state that we shouldn't forget at the moment, that it was centralized, it was bureaucratized, it was hard to push through changes and so forth. So we shouldn't return to that. But at the same time, I think what especially the Social Democrats, what they really don't understand was what was the genius of the welfare state and their own construction. Was that it produced a society that had a collective subjectivity. There were instances within the society that interpolated, for lack of a better term, people as a collective entity, that they were citizens or they were participants in a collective project. But if you have privatization and you have a client or consumer model, then people start acting as a neoliberal economic subject. Public housing is perhaps one of the most important sectors for doing this in Sweden, as it was in England for the Thatcher government. So to move forward, we have to defend what's left of the welfare state as kind of a rigidity in what can be privatized and what the neoliberal way can achieve. But at the same time, we have to start thinking about other types of collective enterprises that can produce a society that in the next step will defend that society and push forward for a more collective, you know, universal welfare state. And I think these have to be new forms. It used to be tied to large centralized workplaces, and those probably won't be around in Europe, and I guess in North America as well for the coming years. And it's hard to politically push through for centralized workplaces. So the big question for left party is how to produce a new universal collective form of subjectivity, and what types of institutions that can produce that, and how they can survive electoral defeats and conjunctural terms. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Peter Nilsson of the Swedish Left Party. That's all for this week. See you in 2 weeks.